Hi, I'm Nick Gregoriadis, and this is the Jiu-Jitsu Brotherhood Podcast, the show for grapplers and martial artists that want to evolve both on and off the mat. Hello, everyone. This is episode 29 of the Jiu-Jitsu Brotherhood show, and today we have a ninja on the episode, and I'm not exaggerating at all. He is a real life ninja. Now, I used to think being a ninja meant that you were hiding out in corners or scaling buildings with grappling hooks and attempt to assassinate people. And that's probably because I watched too many B-grade ninja movies when I was a kid. It turns out that that's not what jiu-jitsu is about. There's a lot more to it than that. And our friend Simon Hiro is going to explain to us the nuances of this pretty misunderstood martial art. Before you guys enjoy the show, I would really appreciate it if you supported us by heading on over to store.jiu-jitsu-brother.com and buying any of our cool gear or training merchandise. You can get it all at 10% off using the coupon code podcast. So head on over and check that out. Also, if you want some CBD products, which there's a lot of anecdotal evidence out there to show that CBD helps relax the body after hard exercise, especially after things like jiu-jitsu, and helps reduce inflammation in the body, head on over to truthnaturals.co.uk, input the code JJBTruth, and you'll get a discount on all their goods as well. And finally, guys, please leave a review for us on iTunes. It really helps a lot. It's one of the things that will help me continue to keep making this show. I know a lot of you guys enjoy it, and you ask if you can help. And that's one of the best ways you can help. Okay, guys, here we go. Episode 29, Simon Hiro. Hey, everyone. Welcome back to the Jiu-Jitsu Brotherhood show. I'm here with a gentleman I met going on, I would say, 15 years ago. His name is Simon Hiro, and he is the head of the Bujinkan Yo Dojo. Is that correct, Simon?
That is correct. Bujinkan Yo Dojo.
That's awesome. Yeah. Okay, I got there in the end. So Simon is a jiu-jitsu black belt under Mauricio Gomez, is that correct?
No, I'm under Hoja.
Oh, cool. Okay, cool.
Yeah.
So that's awesome to hear. And
although Mauricio was kind of responsible for a lot of my education, if you like, in the early days.
Yeah, I remember you doing private lessons with him.
That's right. Uh-huh. That's right. A lot.
There's no one like Mauricio. He's a one of a kind, that guy.
Yeah.
What a special man. So,
a lot.
Simon, you... one of the main reasons I wanted to have you on the show is because you have a very interesting background when it comes to the martial arts. So you are there's no other way to put it. You're a ninja. Is that correct?
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. At the end of this year, I was quite surprised. I had a guy that lives in Japan over to, I hosted a seminar for him at the end of the year. He lives in Japan, trains regularly with his Japanese grandmaster, Masaki Hatsumi, who's sort of only legitimately recognized ninja grandmaster. Yeah, and there's loads of books and stuff that he's written and stuff, and it's the stuff that caught my eye back in the sort of 80s and 90s. Mm-hmm. But anyway, this guy came, did his seminar. At the end of it, he produces this certificate for me, which I was quite surprised about, which made me one of the few top instructors in that art. So it's called a Daishihan certificate, and it sort of means that I'm a notable instructor in Japanese, basically. So
that's cool. How did you? Well, I mean, I guess I'll preface my question. Ninjutsu, I don't really know anything about it except what I learned watching American Ninja 1 and 2 with Michael Dudikoff when I was a kid.
We do stuff like putting that bucket on the head and Venus.
Man, I was obsessed with those movies when I was a kid, and that's one of the...
The Japanese teaching license in it, you have to kneel down. The Japanese grandmaster, in my case, stood behind me with a shinai, which is, you know, a kendo sword, bamboo sword. And he'll hold it up in the air and he'll try and hit you on the head, and you have to get out of the way before you get hit. You can't see him. You've just got to kind of feel. You can't, if you hear it, it's too late. The sword's moving too fast. It's a very, very weird experience. It defies my total scientific upbringing to that stage.
That's wild. I want to hear. I'm going to ask you more questions about that kind of stuff in a bit. But yeah. Can you tell me a little bit about how you came to be involved in training ninjutsu?
Okay, so when I was very young, so I'm talking about sort of 9 to like 13, mm-hmm. I used to play all mainstream sports. So I used to do being the first team for rugby and cricket and stuff, like going to like a private school. That's the kind of curriculum for us there. So I went to the older private school, public school. Weirdly, at the school I went to was judo, and I'd literally just dumped everything. Even though I've been sort of really involved in all the sport, I just wanted to do judo. I didn't care about anything else. All I wanted to do was judo. Mm-hmm. So I started doing judo, and I did that for about 5 years, three times a week. I won like a public schools championship twice, and did various competitions in the Brighton area. Then on leaving school, I would started doing Kyokushin karate, actually, because I thought I want to do some striking and stuff like that. Mm-hmm. Kyokushin karate under a guy who's quite famous in the UK called Steve Arnell. He used to come down from London once in a while and teach in the local club that I was a member of. And then I started getting into kung fu. There's a guy, again, around where my parents live that taught kung fu. So I did that for about 3 years. And then I went to university, and I started, weirdly, a guy that's now training in BJJ called Ebi Gansa used to teach taekwondo there. Mm-hmm. And there's a very weird story about that as well. But I trained taekwondo under him, and he was in the squad that went to Seoul when taekwondo was being the sort of introduced into the Olympics.
Okay.
So that was kind of interesting. And then all the time I was doing all of this, there are these books by a guy called Stephen Hayes, by the Japanese grandmaster called Masaki Hatsuma, I've mentioned before. And I was going, man, that looks freaking interesting, that stuff. So it's always bubbling away in the background. So in about 87, I went and started training. And then I think within a couple of years, I've been going to Japan, and then I was training this Japanese grandmaster to move around the world and train at different locations in the world, hence why I've been to Tucson before, was one of the locations he was teaching for 3 days, and just got fully immersed in it. So during the, you know, in my life before being married and having children, in the summer, I used to go and train martial arts with this Japanese grandmaster. And then in the winter, I used to ski like 55 days a year. So that would go on. Like, I used to have quite a reasonably nice lifestyle.
Okay, so I got to stop you there. So, I mean, that does sound like a reasonably nice lifestyle. And
yeah,
I remember coming into the academy. This was when I was a purple belt. It was one of the first times I met you. You were doing some private lessons with Mauricio, if I'm not mistaken, at the time.
Yes.
And I mean, this was shortly after I just arrived in London with I think a couple of quid in my pocket.
Called Crazy Horse, I remember.
Yes,
I
think. There was another South African guy called Crazy Horse who, very interesting cat. And I remember you wheeling in this bicycle, which, if I remember correctly, it was the same one that Lance Armstrong had been riding, because cycling's a hobby of yours.
Yeah, that's
the same
right,
one he'd been
right,
riding, yeah. Like literally the exact same bike he'd been riding in the Tour de France for the US Postal team. And I remember saying to you, like, wow, this is a pretty impressive bike. How much does it cost? And you, I think it was 15,000 quid at the time, which is about 20,000.
It wasn't as much as 7 grand, I think.
Okay. Yeah. So I remember thinking to myself, God damn, I wonder if I'm ever going to be in a position one day when I can afford something that costs 7 grand just
and
for
I
a hobby.
I remember picking you up from Battersea in my Porsche once, I think.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
I used to have like exotic cars as well in my, you know, again, before I had a wife and children.
That pesky wife and children, huh?
Ruined my life.
I guess the question I'm digging towards here is, what has allowed you, I mean, you're obviously a successful businessman, and how did you get that way? What's the industry you're in, and can you share a little bit about your journey?
So when I was younger, I started off doing accountancy, which I tell you, I absolutely hated. So I worked as an accountant for two years, trying to get my chartered accountant's ticket, and it was mind-blowingly and mind-numbingly terrible. So I quit that. And then I had a period of where I just used to hang out in nightclubs, basically. I used to go to Stringfellows, basically, which is where all the celebrities used to go before it was a strip bar. You know, it was like the hot night spot in London.
I can see you doing that, actually.
Yeah. And so I was thinking, man, what I want to do? And I thought, what I want to do is, you know, I could see people in the city earning a lot of money, but what they didn't have was any time. So they're like mercilessly on this like money printing machine, you know, thing where they couldn't get off and they had no real time. So I ended up working for Harvey Goldsmith's, who's a concert promoter, his brother, and he runs a merchandise company. And he basically dealt with the entertainment industry. So very quickly, his friend was working there as well. We worked with him. He was a complete idiot to work for. It was almost impossible to work for. Had no idea about how to treat clients, making our lives very difficult. So anyway, we left, set up our own company. Within 1 year, all the clients had come to us. We didn't poach them. We just said, look, we're setting up somewhere else. If you want to stay where you are, that's fine. If you want to come to us, that's great.
Mm-hmm.
So we know it's up to you. So we were confident that we'd always win business. So a load of clients came to us. In the first year, I had a Porsche.
That's awesome.
It just made such a change from earning something like $30,000 a year to earning way, way more than that in just one small change of detail, which was setting up your own business.
Wow. And so I guess something I'm trying to get into more and more is like I've been fortunate enough. Maybe fortunate isn't even the right word. I've worked fucking hard, but I've had a bit of good luck and timing.
Yeah.
And I'm in a similar situation. I'm not a wealthy person, but I do run my own business, and I do have the time to pursue the things I enjoy, like martial arts.
It's so important, and I tell you, bringing up children. So I came from a family where my parents, my father's a surgeon, my mum was a GP, and they were working the whole time. You know, I barely knew them until I was about 17.
Mm-hmm.
And there were a few issues that I've had to resolve in myself as a consequence to that. And now I teach children. One of the biggest problems I see with children today is two working parents, or even one of them that's working all the time. Because when I'm teaching the kids, I'll see a badly behaved child or poorly behaved child, and I go, man, okay. And I'll go and speak to them, you know, I'll say, you know, what's the deal here? And 95% of the time, even 99% of the time, it's because both parents are working.
Wow.
An absence during their child's formative years.
Okay, so I mean, I'm not going to argue with that. It sounds logical. But I guess where I wanted to take the conversation is so let's say there's someone out there listening to this and they find themselves in that situation where they're trading their time for money and not even necessarily a lot of money, and they know that they're missing their child's developmental years and they want to make a change and they want to start their own business. What advice could you give them that would stop them from making some of the mistakes that you made in the beginning, and also help them do... Well, I was going to say, also help them do some of the things you did right early.
I think that the first thing, you know, what I always thought, you know, on my way through my life is timing is like so important. Is so I wasn't in a rush to get married. I wasn't in a rush to have kids and stuff. And what I wanted to do is try. What I was guilty, perhaps, is overthinking stuff.
Welcome to the club, my friend.
Yeah. So I'm a person that tends to think about stuff a lot and then react. What I'm learning to do now is so it's a difficult thing. It's chicken and egg. So my belief is you have to train your instincts to be correct. So it's like jiu-jitsu. When you start doing jiu-jitsu, you're freaking hope, you know, you first of all, you don't know what to do. Then you learn a few techniques, and then you have to struggle with accessing those techniques. When you can relax, then you can access all the genius that you have in your body.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what I'm struggling with at the moment. So I think to answer your question, in the early stages, what you have to do is you have to be really good at what you do. And I think some of your other people that you've had on this podcast have said is you've got to offer something rather than be thinking, how can I make money out of something?
Mm-hmm. What value can I provide?
Yes, good value. And people want to come back. And, you know, it's such an interesting observation. Some of the stuff that your guides have said on the podcast in the past have really resonated with me and also made me reflect on how I can do a better job as well. So, you know, I've been a big fan of your podcast.
Thanks so much, Simon. It's good to, I mean, the thing I love about this show is that I get to speak with people like you. It's not even work for me. It's such a pleasure. So I wanted to ask you, Simon, let's get back to ninjutsu, man.
Yes.
So, look, as a lifelong martial artist, and as I said earlier, I was a little jiu-jitsu fanboy when I was a kid, based on pretty imperfect information being those films. It's my understanding, and I know it's wrong, but ninjutsu was a martial art that was, or not a martial art, a collection of knowledge that was designed to help people in the art of assassination. Is that way off base?
No, that's absolutely not true. So obviously within all sort of minority groups, you know, as we're finding out even nowadays, there's bad people and there's good people. So my understanding of it is that historically there were sort of minority groups in Japan, in feudal Japan, that kind of moved out of society, which, you know, they had slightly different belief systems. So they set themselves up in the mountains of Japan, of the main islands of Japan, and they believed more in sort of nature and Shugendo, which is like a more spiritual view of, rather than the sort of Shinto Buddhism and stuff that was popular through the rest of the land. But as a consequence to that, of being sort of out on a limb and being different to people, they were persecuted, is my understanding.
Okay.
So, no, they were regularly attacked by the shoguns and the local warlords, etc., etc. And so out of that was bred a way of existing close to nature, obviously, because they were essentially farmers living in a very hard area of Japan. So they learned how to exist close to nature, and within that came fighting skills, et cetera, et cetera. Some of them then, because there's no sustainability there, where as the families and clans grew bigger, then members had to move to other parts of Japan to get work and earn money, et cetera, et cetera. Mm-hmm. And through that was a network of spies, basically. So if someone said, okay, we want to know what's going on in this port in Japan, wherever, Kyoto, they'll go, okay, I'll phone my uncle or my uncle's brother who is there. And so there was a network. But then, as I say, some of them then used their skills for bad, you know, properly bad things like assassination, et cetera, et cetera. Okay. But that was a very small part of it. And it should not, you know, as we all know, we shouldn't judge a whole lot of people by the actions of a few.
Fair enough. So, I mean, this has really intrigued me. I'd like to know, besides combat techniques, and I'm sure, like, so there's unarmed combat techniques.
Oh, yes,
I'm guessing are kind of similar to Japanese jiu-jitsu. Would that be correct?
So what's weird? So everyone thinks this ninja stuff is like, man, it's got all these deadly moves and stuff. It's not. You see, the thing is if you think about it, what ninja were, they're like special forces. So really, the last thing they want to do is engage with fighting the enemy. Mm-hmm. So normally, there'll be like three or four of them trying to get into, say, a castle or whatever. But what they don't want to do is be fighting an enemy. So fortunately enough for the grandmaster that I study under has three schools of ninjutsu and six schools of classical jujitsu.
Okay.
So when you start to learn the system, what you originally have gone there to learn is you think, actually, this is like trying to get away from people rather than, so there's a lot of stuff where people are grabbing your wrist and you're releasing it and escaping.
Oh, that's cool.
And not getting in caught up in fighting. Your only objective is to get away.
It sounds like really practical self-defense, way more practical than 99.9% of the other bullshit that's taught out there.
Yeah, but although having said that, things have obviously changed. So the jujitsu stuff, and this is the issue that I have, because my way of teaching it all now is to try and make it more 21st century.
Okay.
So obviously the jujitsu stuff comes from, as you may know, from the battlefield of Japan, mm-hmm. Centuries old medieval Japan. So the last thing you want to do is be on the ground. You know, if you're on the ground, someone's going to stick a spear in you or stab you, with a sword. So there's very, very little good ground fighting in it. Obviously, with my background in Gracie Jiu-Jitsu, this is the sort of stuff. So nowadays, if you fight, the biggest growing art is MMA. Mm-hmm. I think we can all accept that. Mm-hmm. So everyone thinks, you don't want to take someone on the ground to beat them up because their friend might put a knife in your back or break a chair over your head. I totally agree. Absolutely agree with that. You do not want to set out to take someone on the ground. But if someone drags you on the ground or you slip, or, the thing is, you can never guarantee you will not end up on the ground. Mm-hmm. You need to know how to escape. Triangles, arm bars, chokes.
It's a very good point, yeah. You need to know how to stand up and get away as well.
Exactly. This is the point. So everyone always tries to look at it from the point of view of we shouldn't be on the ground in the first place. Mostly you will not have a choice. Uh-huh. And that's my sort of area of expertise in the Bujinkan arms. Uh-huh. It's to try and sort of figure that out for people help people that want to understand that part of the journey.
That's very specialized. I think next time I'm in the UK, I'm going to come do some training with you and learn some of that. Yeah. I'm fascinated. Those who listen to the show regularly know that I'm fascinated by pretty much all things Japan.
How many times I've been there. I've totally lost count.
It's what a place, man. I consider it one of the great privileges of my life to have been able to see Japan.
And more so than that, I went on tour with Hoist Gracie in, I think, 2001 for about 2 weeks.
Oh, I want to hear more about
all
that.
All the way around Japan, and we were sharing a room. He ended up actually sleeping on the floor a lot of times. I said, Simon, you can have the bed today. And I said, man, you've been working. I said, no, I'll sleep on the floor tonight.
Okay. And how did, I guess, the first thing that comes to mind when you relate that is, I'd like to know how the Japanese, I'm guessing that this tour was to teach Newaza Jiu-Jitsu to Japanese people. And how did they accept him? How did they...
I'll tell you what was really weird, which you really not expect, or I didn't expect. So when you go to a seminar and you're sparring with people, and it's mostly obviously like the newer people to the art, if you like, go absolutely balls out, like 100% strength, and go completely crazy. So I always thought, okay, Japanese people have a much better idea of, I always see it as a Western trait, that to show that you're trying to do something or impress the instructor, you've got to go, completely crazy. So I always thought that was a Western kind of philosophy, that where you think you've got to work hard because that shows you're doing stuff. Anyway, it was a lot of the Japanese were doing exactly the same. And I remember him saying loads of times, it's like, guys, you've got to relax because you can't even see where I'm catching you. Mm-hmm. You're suddenly arriving in my submission and you have no idea how it came about. It just appears to you because you're so stressed out and you're working so hard that you can't actually see what's going on.
Yeah, are you saying that they were disrespectful in that approach, or
not disrespectful? They did what I didn't. Is I thought they'd have more, and maybe it was a silly thing for me to think, but I thought they'd be more sort of like
restrained.
What I want to do is feel what he's doing.
Yeah,
I thought they had more insight as beginners than perhaps Western people. And what was weird is it was pretty much the same. Of course, you had a lot of people that did go, okay, I'm just going to try and survive. Yeah. and feel what's going
that's
on.
That's cool.
There's quite a few people that were going like absolutely balls out. And I remember him saying he used to get a bit annoyed with them, to be honest. And he's just saying, guys, why are you going so crazy? Yeah. You know, you can't feel anything.
You don't learn in that state, right?
What I'm doing.
I picked up, I didn't pick this up recently. I've known this for a long time, but I was reminded of it in I think it was a documentary I saw recently, which was speaking about how human beings learn most quickly when they play. Oh no, this is what it was. I remember it was a documentary about crows and the intelligence of crows and corvids,
yeah.
That family of birds, and what they showed.
Those are the eyes of the ninja and sort of like mythological.
That's cool. So this ties in really well then, right?
That's great. Yeah.
So in this documentary, it was showing that they had footage of crows playing. Like it absolutely blew my mind. There was a crow sitting on the top of a roof of a house, and he was taking a piece of bark or something, and he was using it as a snowboard to snowboard down the. I mean, I wouldn't have believed it unless I'd seen it with my own eyes. Yeah. And what
they
it's unbelievable. So the finding that they come up with is, or the theory that they'd come up with is that all intelligent species like primates and corvids play, because play is when you learn most quickly.
Man, that's so weird, because this is what I tell the parents of the children that I teach. It's like, if you look at any animal, like all the small, the babies basically do, as you say, play, mm-hmm. and wrestle with each other, mm-hmm. to form out how to use their bodies effectively. Now, it's an essential part. And I think because of this thing in schools now where, you know, of course, you've got tarmacked playgrounds and stuff. A lot of that, you know, because when I was a kid, you know, we were slightly different because I grew up in the countryside. So there was grass and there was, you know, and we were just rolling around wrestling each other the whole time. Mm-hmm. That was what we did.
That's cool.
You know, and now say to the kid, can you get that guy in a headlock? They go, what?
you can see straight away. I notice a big difference in the rate at which people learn. And it's very closely linked to how playful their approach is. It's the guys who are going flat out. Like they insist that every match be a fight to the death. And, yeah. and they're the guys who are like, yeah, they get better in the beginning for a short while because they're very physical and they're very dominant, but they either get injured or they plateau.
Blue belt mentality, isn't it? That thing that you need to get through to the purple belt is you've got to release your strength.
Mm-hmm.
You've got to go, okay, if this guy really wants to do something, I'm not going to blow up, burn all my strength and power out fighting him. I've just got to go with him because I'm going to save that for when I've got him more in my trap.
So true. So another thing that one of my defining memories of you as well is for the documentary that Darren Bartlett made about he made about Roger called Tradicia, which means tradition.
Yes, yes,
you tradition, bought yeah. in you've got a collection of katana and wakizashi and tanto, if I'm not mistaken.
Right. That's right.
And
that's
so right. You bought in one of these katana, which was, okay, I remember this figure correctly, I'm sure, which you said it was worth £20,000.
Probably about that, because I think I bought it for about, well, it was a long time ago. It was probably in the very, very early 90s for about $8,000, I think.
Okay.
Wow. So I would have thought, you know, and I think immediately that someone else valued it because I bought it in Sotheby's under in an auction. And it was a weird, that's another weird story how that came to me, because I was looking at a whole load of swords. Well, I went to the viewing first of all, and I go, wow, that's the sword I want. And then, you know, I thought, man, I'm never going to be able to afford that.
Mm-hmm.
And so I went to the auction, and all these shittier swords are going, like there's like two or three Japanese guy antiques buyers, and they were just like throwing money at everything. I go, man, I've totally balls this up. I should have bought one of those shittier ones at a lower price. I'm now going to end up with nothing. Anyway, the one that I really wanted, which is the one I got, came up, and it was like it was invisible, no one saw it.
Weird.
Going, fuck, and I'm thinking, man, no one's putting a bid in. So tentatively put my hand up, and I got, and then of course, then you think, well, I bought a lemon.
What's the catch? Yeah.
looks like a piece of crap. And so I thought, okay, so I go and have it checked out. And they go, no, man, that's a, like 10 grand, you know, like.
That's,
you know,
awesome.
Yeah, yeah, that's, it was great. Bizarre. Yeah.
So
yeah.
I have a dream that I'm definitely going to make a reality one day. I'd love your input on this. I think there's no one better to ask than you. I want to get for my five closest friends, I want to get them each a katana or a wakizashi with a specific, and I want to engrave on each of them. Like, for example, my business partner, he was a doctor for a long time, and I want to have his one say the medicine man engraved on it. Yeah. And my very best friend, he always makes me laugh. He's a really funny guy.
This for my best men at my wedding.
You did something like this? Okay, tell me a little bit more.
It was I did a penknife, which was it was, you know, the folded metal that I use in it's Damascus steel. So okay. I couldn't get a proper Japanese one, but it's got all the layers in it, like mm-hmm. a Japanese mm-hmm. sword has. And I got them all engraved with like a thank you or something.
That's really cool. That's really cool.
So a little penknife, yeah.
If I wanted to do that with the Japanese sword, what is the price range I should be looking for to know that it's not a piece of crap? And it doesn't necessarily have to be like a $30,000 sword, but
I think you have to be in the couple of hundreds.
Okay.
A sword. Once you start to get lower than that, you know, weirdly, you think, oh God, these swords are going to cost a fortune. There's a guy that, you know, often or has like tailor-made swords for me, because the thing with the ninja sword is it has a long scabbard, so it looks like a full length sword, but the actual sword itself is like maybe as much as a third shorter.
I've seen it. It's a straighter blade as well, as opposed to,
it comes out of the scabbard much faster than the person thinks it will.
Okay.
Yeah,
and it's a straighter blade than the traditional.
That was a bit of a myth, to be honest. Okay. I think that was a myth perpetrated by Stephen Hayes, I think.
Oh, fair enough. Okay.
I think a lot of ninja swords were curved, you know, like the samurai sword, you know, proper katana.
That's cool.
And they may not be made to the same quality, perhaps, as some of the samurai swords and katanas, but you know, they had the principle was the same, I think.
That's cool. I mean, so would you suggest having five identical swords made up is a better route to go than trying to find five?
I think so. What I would do is there's a chap that I know, Barrington Swords, and he does some swords at a very, very reasonable price, and he'll probably, you know, if you say you know me, and because I've reviewed stuff for him in the past, he'll do a deal, he'll do a trade deal, I'm sure. You know, through my proper business, which is a merchandising business, you can get them to me and I'll get them laser engraved or something. Oh,
that's cool. I guess, Simon, don't take this the wrong way. I appreciate that offer, but I'm really wanting traditional Japanese.
Brand or something like that.
Oh, damn. Okay. Well, yeah, let's give me the, I'll get the number for your guy after this then, right?
Even more, you know, to have a guy to properly fold one up for you and stuff is going to cost you squillions, because there's only probably about five or six dudes in the world that can do that job.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, and every sword they make is a kind of masterpiece.
Mm-hmm. I don't know if you've ever watched the video I made, Soul of Jiu-Jitsu. And I actually went to Japan to film this. It's like a jiu-jitsu lifestyle.
I'd like to see that. I'd like to see
that. Yeah, you should check it out, because we actually went amazingly.
You went to Public DM, didn't you?
Yeah, well, that's where it was filmed. But one of the guys I was... I taught a seminar there, and one of the guys, somehow his wife knew a sword maker, one of the, like, the, he was,
oh wow,
yeah, like a yeah. Japanese national, he's a Japanese yeah, national that, living treasure.
Those dudes are like seriously revered in Japan.
So we went to see, it was amazing. We took the train out to this little town, wow, and we went to this guy's place and we saw them forging the sword and we got some footage, and it was
that's an experience in itself.
It was cool, but I didn't think at the time to ask him how much they were, because it wasn't that kind of meeting, if you know what I mean. Simon, my man, it's such a pleasure to talk to you. You've shared a lot of wisdom. If the listeners want to find out more about you and what you do, where should they go?
To my website, I guess, which is www.yeodojo.net.
Okay, got it.
Yeah, yeah. yeah, I'm on there.
Okay, great. I'll put a link up in the show notes. But man, what a pleasure to speak to you. And I will see you again on the mats in London sometime this year.
Yeah. Yes, yeah. And are you doing seminars over here?
Every time I visit the UK, I try to get in a couple, so I'll definitely stop by. And
yeah, so when you're in London, I'll see if I can bring some students to it as well.
That'll be great. I'm
hanging, yeah.
My friend, 1,000 blessings on you.
Cool, man. Yeah, nice to talk to you.
I enjoyed that. Simon has a lot of life experience, and he is a lifelong martial artist. I mean, this guy, as he said, toured Japan with Hoist, that must have been pretty cool. I'd love to have been a fly on the wall in some of those seminars back in the day when the Brazilians had just arrived back in Japan and they were reteaching the Japanese their own martial art. I think that must have just been absolutely fascinating. I remember I was in Thailand about 3 years ago, 4 years ago, and I was teaching a seminar at a small academy in Bangkok, and there were a couple of Japanese guys there. And the thought in my mind, it was one of those peak experiences in life where I was like, man, if you had told me when I was a little kid learning judo and starting to be immersed in Japanese culture that one day I would be teaching jiu-jitsu to Japanese people, I never would have believed you. And it was one of those pointers or one of those signposts in my life that I don't want to say I had arrived, but it was a symbol to me that I was on the right track. So I really appreciated Simon's stories of Japan, and his knowledge of swords as well was pretty cool. I hope you guys enjoyed the show. Stay tuned. Next week, we'll have another cool episode for you. Peace out.